Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, the 12th Hour. In the Liberty Hill, Texas, today is August 26, 2014, or as Elu 1, 2018. We will start our third service on this new moon Sabbath with a song entitled, The King is Coming. Marketplace is empty, no more traffic in the street. All the builders' tools are silent, no more time to harvest wheat. Busy housewives cease their labor, in the courtroom no debate. Work on earth is all suspended as the King comes through the gate. Oh, the King is coming, the King is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, and now His face I see. Oh, the King is coming, the King is coming, Grisha is coming for me. Happy faces along the hallway, those whose lives have been redeemed, the broken home that He has mended, those from prison He has freed, little children in the aged, hand in hand stand all aglow. We were crippled, broken, ruined, clad in garments white as snow. Oh, the King is coming, the King is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, and now His face I see. Oh, the King is coming, the King is coming. Grisha is coming for me. I can hear the chariots rumble. I can see the marching throng. The flurry of your trumpet spells the end of sin and wrong. Regal robes are now unfolding, heaven's grand stands all in place. Heaven's choir is now assembled, start to sing amazing praise. Oh, the King is coming, the King is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, and now His face I see. The King is coming, the King is coming. Praise Yah, it's coming. Isaiah, the Gospel Prophet, Part 2, by the M.L. Andreessen. We're on page 14. It said, this time of the Israel's Indian summer, as it has been called, only aggravated conditions. With the prosperity, it came vice blacker and worse than ever. And success against their old enemy, Damascus, attended their arms. Israel took it as an evidence of Elohim's favor and closed their eyes unto the existing evils. Riches and spoil and tribute poured in. And as always, with riches and luxury came corruption, for the continual wars of the last centuries had driven many of the farmers from the soil to the protection of the cities. and the prosperous independent middle classes were gradually disappearing. In their stead came the very rich and the very poor. Oppression, corruption, and injustice were the order of the day. The rich sold the righteous for silver, and the poor for a pair of shoes. Amos 2:6. Moral conditions were worse than ever. Prosperity as well as adversity had failed to bring Elohim's people unto their senses, but Yahweh could do nothing to save them, for the destruction was determined. I will smite the winter house with the summer house, and the houses of the ivory shall perish, as saith the Yahweh. Amos 3:15. They that lie upon beds of ivory and eat the lambs out of the greaves for the affliction of Joseph, they eat the lambs out of the flock that drank wine in the bowl. Okay, let's reread that again. Amos 3:15. It says, they that lie upon the beds of ivory and eat the lambs out of the flock that drink wine in the bowls, that they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. Now shall they go captive with the first that go captive, and the banquet of them that stretch themselves shall be removed. Because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy Elohim, O Israel. Amos 6:4-7. Amos 4:12. For the situation was not much better in Judah. There was outward prosperity as in Israel, but prosperity led to the same result. Elohim had marvelously helped Uzziah, and as long as he sought the Yahweh, Elohim made him to prosper. 2 Chronicles 26:15-5. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Yahweh's Elohim and went into the temple and of the Yahweh to burn incense upon the altar of incense. Verse 16, this is against the Yahweh's plain command, and the king was smitten with that dread disease, leprosy. Being thus shut off from the contact with the people, he associated with him on the throne. But being thus shut off from the contact with the people, he associated himself on the throne, Jotham, his son, and together they ruled 11 years when Uzziah died, and Jotham became sole ruler. It was during this time that Isaiah began his prophetic ministry. He knew the conditions in northern Israel and the messages that he had been sent through Amos and Hosea. He saw that the same condition prevailed in Judah that had brought the northern kingdom to the brink of the ruin, and he well knew that Judah could not escape the fate that threatened Israel unless there was deep repentance and a genuine revival of the righteousness. Unto him the case seemed almost hopeless. What could he, as a young man, do? For the rich were grinding the faces of the poor. They were joining house to house and field to field, drinking and carousing. For the women were interested only in the finery and apparel. The whole land was full of the idols. Isaiah 3:15, 5:8, 11:12, and Isaiah 3:16-24 and Isaiah 2:8. For the king Jotham, though good compared to some others, was a weakling under the influence of his harem, and even the judges were corrupt. Isaiah 3:12 and 10:1-2. Uzziah had been a restraining influence, but he was now a leper, and apparently unrepentant as a leprosy still clung to him, and furthermore, it was reported that he could not live longer. What would then happen? It was in the year that the king Uzziah died, Isaiah 6:1, that Isaiah had his first vision. It was a time of the great discouragement and the dark forebodings. Isaiah shrank from the task before him. for it seemed so utterly hopeless. Judah was fast falling in the footsteps of Israel, and who could stop them? If Hosea and Amos had not been able to hold back in check, how could anything be done to save Judah? Probably also a presentment of his rejection by the king and people came to Isaiah, and he would most certainly know that this message would not be accepted by the priest any more than were those of Amos, Amos 7, 10-13. What Judah needed was a prophet that would stir the conscience of the people and rouse them from the lethargy, preparing them for the crisis before them. And Isaiah was very doubtful that he was the man. In fact, he felt that he was not. He was undone, Isaiah 6:5. Even it was with thoughts such as these that the great vision came to him. He had evidently gone up to worship when suddenly the vision rises before him. The Yahweh is seen sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and his train fills the temple. Okay, pay close attention, folks, and here's this message, because this is what Elijah David is seeing in the mental vision right now. I just read to you what Judah needed was a prophet that would stir the conscience of the people and rouse them from the lethargy, preparing them for the crisis before them. Well, Israel is in a crisis today. The United States is in a crisis. And where is the David of today? Well, Yahweh is preparing his antitypical David, and he's preparing him out in the outback, and he will, like David of old did, he will all of a sudden come from out of nowhere into the camp of Israel, and there he is, clothed as a little shepherd boy with a loin's cloth off and a slingshot, and all of his three brothers and all the rest of the army of Israel was all decked out in army apparel, fighting apparel. They had their swords and their shields, and they were honing them to go into battle. And here's a little shepherd boy come in and wonder what all the flurry was about. Two armies gathered facing off with each other with the valley in between. And here they are jumping all over this little shepherd boy coming down, dressed in a half dress. And what did he do? He comes in and he caused a consternation among the army of Israel. And he said, well, isn't there a cause? He said, what are you condemning me for? Isn't there a cause? He said, yeah. We've got to put up one man to fight that big beast up there on the hill, that Goliath. We're going to have to go into pit army against army. And today is our last day. This is the 40th day that we have been challenged and taunted by this here Goliath. And we don't have a man among us, including our King Saul, that has got enough nerve to go up and fight this man one-on-one. David said, in other words, David said, is that all? Is that all you need? Is just a man to go fight with him? He said, well, I'll go fight with him. Now, can you imagine his brothers standing there with all the men of Israel all dressed out in war apparel with their swords and shields? And this little shepherd boy with just a loin's cloth on and a staff in his hand and a slingshot on over his shoulder. Oh, well, I'll go fight with him. 10 foot tall, 600, 700, 800 pound mammoth up there on the hill. I mean, he's all dressed out in army apparel, clear down from his head to his toe. Even got his eyes covered with a shield. And all of his legs and everything covered with brass. I mean, you couldn't touch that big man with a slingshot. Gonna hurl a little rock at him? Is that what you're gonna do? Oh, man. He said, well, I'll do it. And they said, well, Somebody go around and tell the king, we got a man here that's willing to volunteer to go fight this man. He said, talk to him. And so King Saul looked at David and he said, oh man, you can't go fight this man. This man's a man of war. And you're just a little shepherd boy. And so David said, you know what happened one day while I was herding sheep? He said, why, a lion came in to my little flock and took the lamb out. And I run after him and I grabbed him by his beard and I smote him. And my bare hands, I killed that big old lion and delivered the little lamb out of his paw. And he said, then a bear came into my flock and took a lamb out. And said, I went after that bear and I grabbed him and I smote him with my bare hands. Well, they knew David didn't make this up. And they also knew that David had been anointed by Samuel earlier to be the next king of Israel. And that's one reason why they didn't like David. They didn't like the little shepherd boy getting the honor of bypassing them to be the next king of Israel after King Saul. They knew this. So, but David wasn't to be denied. Yahweh sent him into the camp of Israel to deliver it, not only the army of Israel, but deliver the whole land of Israel. Same thing today. We got them besieging Jerusalem. Go read Zechariah 14. That's what's going on today. So Yahweh is calling now. He's calling for, and that's what I'm preparing myself. I'm going to be preparing myself here to take and go confront this issue with the nations of the Philistines and their leader, Goliath. I'm preparing myself to meet that crisis here one day, if Yahweh willing, and if He's willing, and then He will open up the way and He will endow me and prepare me, and I won't be fighting with my strength. I'll guarantee this, or my words, or at my time. I know not the time, and I don't know what the words will be, and I don't. All I know is it won't be my strength. It'll be His strength, like it was with David, like it was with Samson. And if He chooses to use one man again to deliver Israel and the nations out of the paw of the lion and the bear. Okay. Let's continue our reading now. So now, it said it was with the thoughts such as these that the great vision came to him, Isaiah, for he had evidently gone up to worship when suddenly the vision arises before him. For the Yahweh is seen sitting on a throne high and lifted up, and his train fills the temple. For the seraphim, a high order of angels, cry, holy, 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 the foundations of the threshold shake at the voice of the angels, and the house is filled with the smoke of the incense. At the sight of this, Isaiah cries out in anguish, woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Yahshua of the host, Isaiah 6:5. Now, Isaiah here, about 500 years before the cross, before Yahshua actually appears on this earth in the form of a human being, born of a man and a woman, earthly woman, that is, I mean, born not of a man, but of an earthly woman, mother. Yet Isaiah sees him in vision. He said, oh, I see this King, the Yahshua of hosts, Isaiah 6:5. This vision was a great decisive event in the Isaiah's history. Okay. For it settled his career, his destiny. Henceforth, men could not intimidate him. He had seen the Yahshua, the King of hosts. He had seen him. The lips had been touched with the coals from off the altar. From now on, they were to be dedicated wholly unto Yahweh. Holy, holy, holy. Whatever rang in the prophet's ears. He had seen the King, the Yahshua of hosts. As the live coal was laid on the Isaiah's mouth, the wonderful words were spoken. Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin is purged. Verse 7. For the first time Isaiah now hears the Yahshua's words, voice, as he asks, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? With the exalted joy as well as the deep humility, Isaiah answers, Here am I, and then prays, Send me. The answer comes back immediately, Go. Verse 8 and 9 in Isaiah 6. Before this vision, Isaiah had shrunk from the responsibility that would be his should he accept the call to the Yahshua's messenger, to be the Yahshua's messenger. Let's do that again. Before this vision, Isaiah had shrunk from the responsibility that would be his should he accept the call to be the Yahshua's messenger. After he had seen the Yahshua, he willingly offered himself for the service. The Yahshua now instructs him what to say unto the people, plainly telling him that they will neither understand nor accept his message, as the Isaiah doubtless is warning as to the use of the preaching to such a people and how long he should continue. The Yahshua tells him to preserve as long as there are any people left until the land is utterly desolate, verse 11. His work was not to be entirely fruitless. There shall be left a tenth, verse 13, which should be as the stump of a sturdy oak that still retains its life and will survive. Those that were thus left were to be called the holy seed. It is interesting to note how Isaiah, all through his ministry, clings to the thought of the remnant who shall survive. His work was not to be a complete failure. Elohim himself had said there would be a remnant. This thought buoyed him up, and he reversed to it again and again all through his book, Lessons for Today, Isaiah 6:1. The year that King Uzziah died, the experience which Isaiah had that day in the temple left such a deep impression upon him that it was ever fresh in his mind. The year that the king Uzziah died was not an ordinary year to Isaiah. It was a year, it is well for us to remember Elohim's mercy and recall his blessings. Would it not be well for us to observe holidays unto Elohim when we could revive in our minds the memory of his dealing with us? Would it not be well to consider his past blessings, to remember the impressive warnings that have come home to our souls, so that we shall not forget Elohim's counsel, strategic page 343. Okay, so these holidays that Sister White is talking about here, Viki Hardiff, L.M.L. Anderson is quoting from, he says, It was the year, it is well for us to remember Elohim's mercy and recall his blessing. Would it not be well for us to observe holy days? I'm going to change the holidays now to holy days. This is what it should be, anyway. Holy days unto Elohim. Well, we observe holy days unto Elohim because we have been given light on the correct time for doing this, and we publish a creation calendar that puts us back on the true time for observing all of Yahweh's holy days during the year. And those holy days involve 70 holy days. In a 52-week calendar, year by year, we have 70 holy days that comes upon our creation calendar within the confines of 1 year. And within 52 weeks, we observe 70 holy days, 52 seventh-day Sabbaths, a 12 new moon Sabbath, and today is a new moon Sabbath. That's one of these here, 12, in the year that we observe. And we're observing that here today on a Tuesday. But it happened to fall on our creation calendar as the first day of the month of Elul, which is the sixth month of the lunar year. So we're observing the sixth new moon for this year, of this year. And it's called a holy day. And that's what holidays are for man. And man set aside days for men to have holidays, meaning the days are hollow from having to do any work. That's why they call them holidays. They should have put H-O-L-L-Y. Or they should put it H-O-L-L-Y, Hollywood days. Okay, let's go on. I saw also the Yahshua. When Isaiah saw the Yahshua, it was more than his form or appearance. He saw his holiness, his character, and he received cleansing as well as forgiveness, a commission as well as a vision. We too should thus see the Yahshua, and I'll add my part, in his true holiness with a vision in our mind. And we can do this by observing all of his statutes and commandments and keeping all of his commandments. Now, your mainline, mainstream preachers in the Protestant Christian world will tell you that just love the Lord with all your heart, with all your mind and soul, and your neighbor as yourself, and that's observing the two great commandments, and that's all there is to observe. Well, I guarantee by doing that, believing that, and attempting to do that, doesn't get you the vision of his holiness, sitting high and lifted up on his throne, and being observed as having those four characteristics that I just read to you. His holiness, his character, and his forgiveness, and his cleansing. His cleansing as well as forgiveness, and his commission as well as a vision. Oh my goodness. So by beholding him in his true holiness, beholding him, as the Bible says, by beholding we become changed. Okay? So when you behold him, you become changed, and you receive of his character, you receive of his holiness, which is, he says, his righteousness he gives to us, and he received cleanliness and forgiveness, a commission as well as a vision. My goodness, there's about six things right there that you get. Let's continue on. Verse 2. Covered his face. Reverence is fast disappearing from the hearts of men. Reverence for the holy thing, for the Sabbath, for the house of Elohim, for those in the authority, in the church, and in the state, for virtue, for the word of the Elohim, for the law. How little of it is found today. Yet true religion must be founded on the reverence, or it is not religion. Verse 3. Holy, holy, holy. In its original derivation, the Hebrew word holy means separate, apart from, distinct. Holiness is a central virtue in the Elohim's character, and the Yahshua's character, his son, that includes all others. For the Yahweh is love, light, goodness, and all his other separate characteristics. But the one inclusive trait is holiness. And without holiness, no man can see him. Stainless, holiness, perfect purity, utter and eternal hostility, and every shade and taint of the sin, that is Elohim's character. That's Yahshua's character, Father and Son. Verse 5, woe is me. For the immediate effect upon Isaiah of seeing Elohim was a profound sense of his own unfitness. Woe is me, he cried. He that has seen Elohim has also seen himself. And he that has not seen himself has not seen Elohim. Whosoever trusts his own righteousness thereby proclaims to the world that he has seen neither Elohim nor himself. that he is blind. Verse 5, unclean lips. Unclean lips reveal an unclean heart. Cleanse the heart and the lips will be clean. May Elohim keep us from suggestive slangy phrases, indelicate stories, ribald songs, unseemly jokes, undue familiarity. Be ye clean that bear the vessels of Yahweh. Isaiah 52:11. Verse 7, thy iniquity is taken away and thy sin is purged. Here fire is used as a cleansing agency. Numbers 31:23. It is possible then to come in contact with the fire of the divine holiness and live. Isaiah 33:14. But would Isaiah have lived had he not accepted the cleansing? Verse 8, whom shall I send? So Yahweh did not directly ask Isaiah to go. He asked a question that gave Isaiah a chance to volunteer. That is the way that of Yahweh. Had he said, Isaiah must be willing and obedient. If they did not accept this gracious offer, judgment will come. The second division, verse 21 to 31, deals principally with the judgment. Verse 21-23, Jerusalem has fallen from her high estate. Their princes are the leaders in the backsliding. They are rebellious and accept bribes and do not care for the oppressed. Verse 24 to 31. There shall come a change, however, for the prophet looks forward unto the time when the destruction of the transgressors and of the sinners shall be together. And they that forsake Yahshua shall be consumed. That is the final judgment. Then the Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. And this new Jerusalem is the house of David that has been set up here in the Liberty Hill, Texas, as of 2003. Okay, what did we just learn? Let's read this again. It says that in verses 24 to 31, there shall come a change, however, for the prophet looks forward unto the time when the destruction of the transgressors and of the sinners shall be together. And they that forsake the Yahshua and the Yahweh his Father shall be consumed. That, of course, is the final judgment for not only the house of Israel, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but also for all the transgressors of his law worldwide, of all the churches together, collectively. Okay, so the final judgment, then the Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Well, I can read that description to you in several parts of the Bible, especially in Zechariah 14. After that last war of Zechariah 14 is fought here on earth in the 12th parabolic hour, which is, a matter of fact, it's already ongoing right now. Zechariah 14 war. It's now just it's going into its third month. Okay, even as we speak right here at the end of August. June, July, and August, or July and August, have been the main 2 months when this battle of Armageddon, that the world don't understand the nature of that, but I know the prophets do, and the prophets laid it down in prophecy, and it's only for those with the eyes to see and ears to hear of the inspiration can exactly know the signs and how to read them and how to apply them correctly to what's unfolding in the world, and that is the unfolding of this last great battle of Armageddon, which is unfolding right now. It's already, as a matter of fact, it's already ongoing. Has been, like I said, for 2 months. And the world doesn't even know it. The world won't even accept the fact that Obama represents the Antichrist that's already come. He's already here. He's the president of the United States and the world governments. of the beast. He was inaugurated as the President of the World by the UN in 2010, about September sometime. He sat upon a seat that no president has ever sat on before for that inauguration. They said when the first President of the United States sits in that seat, that is when he will be crowned as the President not only of the United States, but of the world. Obama sat in that seat at the UN in 2010, and people don't even think about it. He's an antithetical Satan, Lucifer. As a matter of fact, his name Barack Obama in the Hebrew, the meaning for Barack Obama, which are Hebrew words and names, it means the names of Satan in the Hebrew. So if you want to go find Satan's name in the Hebrew, you go look it up and it'll tell you that it's Barack Obama. Now that was recorded 3,000 years ago, folks, in the Paleo-Hebrew language, in the alphabet. It's in the alphabet and it's in the language. That's already an over 3,000 year recording. All right, let's go ahead. Notes, Isaiah 1:7, it is not known for a certainty to what time this refers. It must, of course, have been at the time of one of the invasions of Judah, either by the Assyrians or the allied Assyrians and the Ephraimites. Yeah, they confederated together, all right, but they didn't come against Judah. Only Sennacherib came down against Judah, the Assyrian. Yeah, and he took all the cities of Judah. And then the last city left standing was Jerusalem, and he sent his messengers into Jerusalem saying, there's been no man or no city has been able to stand before me. Said, they've all fallen. Said, you can't either. Said, give it up. And Hezekiah, the king, went before Yahweh, the king of Judah. He laid out the scroll of the law, and he said, we're faithful to keep all your statutes and commandments. We need deliverance, Heavenly Father. King Sennacherib, he's king of Assyria. He's come down with 185,000 soldiers, and nobody's been able to stand before him. But he's challenging now your holy city, Jerusalem, and we're keeping all your statutes and commandments and keeping this city holy. So this is your city, Yahweh, and he's asking Yahweh to send his son, Yahshua, by the Spirit, to defend that, and he did. And so he sent a message by Isaiah, says, go back into the palace and tell King Hezekiah that not one arrow will come into the city. And sure enough, the next morning, they went out and found 185,000 soldiers, the complete army of a Sennacherib, dead on the ground. Sennacherib heard a rumor. Back in his own land, he fled back to his temple. And he fled into it to the temple of Dagon. And lo and behold, his own sons followed him in there and slew him right there in his own temple. So that ended the threat for Judah and Israel. Yahweh fighting the battle for him because they had one king, Hezekiah, that was keeping all of Yahweh's statutes in judgment and insisting that Jerusalem do the same thing and all of his inhabitants. And by commanding obedience to all of Yahweh's statutes and judgments and commandments, Yahweh fought for Jerusalem, but Yahweh won't fight for Jerusalem today. The leaders Netanyahu and them will keep giving in to the demands of the enemy, the Assyrians. The Palestinians, which represents the Assyrian yoke around Yahweh's people's neck. And as long as you've got weak leaders that are uncircumcised and unsanctified, you will never have nothing but as I just read to you earlier, when Ahaz, the king of Judah, gave in and compromised with the Assyrians and made alliance with them. Said the Assyrians come in and took them over and they stole all of their gold and silver and sacred vessels out of the temple and took it back to Babylon with them. Okay. What's the difference today, folks? Isaiah's prophecies are not always in the chronological order, and this chapter was probably not first in order of the time. Verse 8. Cottage is both, or is booth, for a cottage is booth in the ARV. Well, I don't understand. Seventh-day Adventist ministers quoting from anything but the KJV, the King James Version. Because they quote from Sister White vociferously, and Sister White says, and the ministers back then, that the KJV, she was shown in vision, no less, by Yahweh, telling Ellen G. White that the King James Version is the only authentic Bible that he approves of. So I know it's bad news for you Protestant people out here, for your Sunday-keeping world, the Protestant Christians that are using all these other translations. Remember what I told you earlier, that there's at least 88 other translations of the King James, and they were all taken from the root foundation of the King James and revised to suit their own inspiration that they wanted to say. So here we are, we got leaders in the Adventist Church that have already been told by their prophet, Ellen G. White, prophetess, that the King James Bible is the only Bible for Adventists, and here we got ministers writing these wonderful articles and directing you to all these other Bible readings, Bible standards. All right, let's go ahead. It says, thieving was common in those days, and it was necessary to watch the crop very closely when it was ripening to protect it from the thieves and perhaps some of the wild animals. A little booth or lodge consisting of the four sticks set in the ground with a bit of canvas for a roof would be erected in the midst of the garden, and there the lonely watcher would sit. This is the picture here used to portray the situation of the Elohim's people alone and forsaken. Okay, verse 10. The rulers of Sodom, really the judges, Elohim here likens Israel unto Sodom and Gomorrah. They had fallen so low that this designation was just. Now, the reason why Yahweh likened Israel unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and I'm going to tell you the real reason. And that is because, if you remember, Sodom means taken from the word Sodom, or the sodomy, it was taken from Sodom. Sodom means man seducing man. Okay? That means a homosexual activity. That means concupiscence. A reprobate sexual deviation, several different types of equal sexual improprieties. And so I can't say that word deviation or whatever. That may be it. It says Yahweh here is likened Israel to Sodom because the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the spiritual Israel of the day, and the sign that she is spiritual Israel of the day because she is a Seventh-day Sabbath observer first and foremost, which is a sign to the Adventists and to the world that she has a candlestick, and that candlestick is the seventh one, Revelation 3:14, the candlestick of Laodicea, meaning the candlestick of the sanctuary of Israel that she's in charge of. So that's what identifies the Adventists as a spiritual Israel church today. But she becomes Sodom when she allows the homosexuals equal rights into her congregations and even endorses them setting up their own church and giving them the money to build their own church and letting them ordain pastors. And all they are is a bunch of homosexual deviant queers. And with a reprobate mind. And the only thing that they've got coming to them is a lake of fire, and they can't escape it, no matter what. And the Adventist General Conference of President on down endorses them and supplies their finances. and endorse them and let them be a member of the administration and let them pay their tithes and offerings to the General Conference with the General Conference blessing. So now you know why the Adventist Church is likened unto Sodom and Gomorrah. And any other Sunday-keeping churches out there of your Gentile world that does the same thing are also sodomites as well. So if you belong to a conglomeration of churches, an organization of churches like the Baptists, and Methodists also, and if you have it in your statutes and judgments of your church manual to endorse and tolerate homosexuality and them to have their own organized churches and be members of your organization and called by your name and paying tithes and offerings to your headquarters, then you're contributors to the most evilest people on the face of the earth that has only one destiny and one end, and that's the lake of fire. You know, Yahweh raised me up like I said. He may not have touched my lips yet with the coals of fire from off the altar, but this is what I'm working for. And when he does, he's going to send me to the world. It'll be after I've been purified coals from off the altar. My lips will be purified, and I will have been purged of all of my iniquity and my sin, and then I'll be qualified. But I know that day is coming if I keep on following the path that he has put me on and that he is guiding me on day by day. That day is coming when I'll feel that I'll be ready to go. And I've always said that I'd probably be 80 years old when that day comes. And my next birthday is 77, so I'm not far from there. But anyway, it says the rulers of Sodom, really the judges. Elohim here likens Israel under Sodom and Gomorrah. They had fallen so low that this designation was judged. Verse 11 to 15. For the priests ministered in the sanctuary and were vitally interested in the sacrificial system. With some exception, a certain portion of each offering belonged unto them. The skin of the burnt offerings was given unto the priest that offered it, Leviticus 7:8. The flour and the oil of the meal, offering, were divided equally among the sons of Aaron, Leviticus 7:9, 10, 6:14-18, Leviticus 2:3. For the beast and the shoulder were also given unto them, Leviticus 10:12-15. It is easily seen that these offerings constituted no small revenue, especially when it is remembered that at the great yearly feast as many as 1 million people were in Jerusalem, each one of whom would bring some offering. The hides alone would bring a large sum. Supposing the people should listen to the prophetic messages and really stop sinning, what would become of the offerings? There would indeed still be praise and thank offerings, but trespass and sin offerings, which constituted by far the larger part of the individual offerings, would cease. Hebrews 10:2. And that would vitally affect the income of the priest. As the priests became corrupted, they were more and more zealous for the observance of the sacrificial law. They would feed on the sin of the people and set their heart on their iniquity, Hosea 4:8. Instead of teaching the people to stop sinning, they would emphasize the virtue of the sacrifices. For the more sin, the more sacrifice. It was not long before the people came to look upon sacrifices as a kind of payment for sin. They reasoned that it was probably better not to sin, but that Elohim was willing to accept a payment instead of obedience. It was, in effect, the idea that sin cost a certain amount of money. Later, the Roman Catholic Church tolerated the same doctrine. And to think that the Seventh-day Adventist Church are the descendants the house of David, the tribe of Judah, that the Pharisees were in occupation of at the cross. And the Adventists are the direct descendants. It took an 1800-year period of separation between the two. But the Adventist Church came on the scene in 1844 as an antitype of those people that crucified Yahshua on the cross. And consequently, the Adventists also get the same title as Sodom and Gomorrah and Sodom and Egypt. You'll find that in Revelation chapter 11. And as I said, any Sunday-keeping Protestant denomination out there doing the same thing, you're just as guilty as Israel is. You're sodomites, and if you're tolerating homosexuals, if you're tolerating them and letting them be a member and participate and using your name and hiding under your umbrella, which your canopy, because they're looking for an identity in the world to be accepted as a organized organization, that's the reason why they want to be a member of your church. They can't go out and start their own new movement, a new organization, and call themselves a bunch of Sodom and Gomorrahites and say, well, we're going to start a whole new movement. We're going to start a bunch of movements and a bunch of queers and homosexuals and everything else, and we're going to hang our banner out and say, we're a whole new organization. Come and join up. How many people do you think of the pure Christian world would do that? None of them. It would only be the sexual deviates in all these churches that the church condemns. They would be the one that would flee the Adventist church. They'd flee the Methodists and the Baptists and everything else and go join this chain, of evil churches. But no, they won't do it because those evil churches got accepted by the mainstream Christian and letting them come in and be a part of them. Oh, brother. Let us go on. It says, as the priests became corrupted, they were more and more zealous for the observance of the sacrificial law. They would feel on the sin of the people and set their heart on their iniquity. Hosea 4:8. Instead of teaching the people to stop sinning, they would emphasize the virtue of sacrifices. For the more sin, the more sacrifice, and the more filthy lucre that they could pilfer and put into their little treasure chest, their little purse, like Judas is carried. He's the only one of the 12 apostles that carried a purse around with him. Yahweh chose the first 11 himself and told him, says, you go with our scripture purse. He said, your bread and your water, be sure. Here comes Judas Iscariot. He wasn't elected by Yahshua as the 12th one. The 11 disciples accepted him because he was so friendly and outgoing and so forth. And he was just so concerned about their welfare that he wanted to carry a purse along and make a little extra money and collect a little bit of extra money along the way so he could help her to relieve their burdens more. And that purse got him in trouble. He put 30 pieces of silver in it that the priest gave him to betray his master. And what happened to the 30 pieces of silver? Judas just carried the old money bags. He had to take it back in the temple and wanted to buy his freedom back and buy his master back that he had betrayed. And the Pharisee says, what has that to do with this? Go your way. You got your filthy lucre. You got your pay. He took the 30 pieces of silver and he put them down the temple floor and he went out and hung himself. Okay. For it was not long before the people came to look upon the sacrifices as a kind of payment for sin. They reasoned that it was probably better not to sin, but that Elohim was willing to accept the payment instead of obedience. It was, in effect, the idea that sin costs a certain amount of money. Later the Roman Catholic Church tolerated the same doctrine. Okay. Against the pernicious belief, the prophets took a definite stand from the beginning. To obey is better than sacrifice. And And then the hearken of the fat of rams, that's in 1 Samuel 15:22. That's always a prophetic message. See also Amos 5:21-23 and Micah 6:7. But this kind of message brought the prophets into the direct conflict with the corrupt priesthood and was often the cause of their persecution and death. Amos 7:10-13. Jeremiah 20:1-2. Jeremiah 26:8. For the careful student of the Old Testament would do well to keep this conflict between the prophets and the priests in mind. It constitutes, in fact, the real background of the Elohim's work for the healing of his people. For the prophetic message was that of the obedience of the spiritual service of the conversion of the holiness. That is the message of Isaiah and the verses under the consideration, and that also is the message of Yahshua. Verse 17, throughout the whole book of Isaiah, the word judgment should be translated justice, as in the American Revised Version. Lessons for today, Isaiah 1:2. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of our study. Actually, for this hour, we'll just do a little review here on what we just read. And our main points is that they say there shall come a change, however. The prophet looks forward unto the time when the destruction of the transgressors and of the sinners shall be together, and they that forsake the Yahweh shall be consumed. That, of course, is the final judgment. Then Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. And ironically enough, in prophecy, this house of David, tribe of Judah, that is raised up in his 12th parabolic hour, to be his lawgiver, the one who the prophecy laid down in Genesis 49:10, says that scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. What is Jacob telling us through the blessing of his 12 sons before he died? He's saying that the tribe of Judah, the lawgiver, is where our Savior is going to come through. And you'll find that in Revelation chapter 5, that Yahshua being this Shiloh, the line of the tribe of Judah, the lawgiver from the tribe of Judah. We'll close this service now with the reading of three verses from the Scripture. I've already given you Isaiah 49:10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh, which is Yahshua, come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. And in Psalm 60:7, it says, Gilead is mine, and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head, and Judah is my lawgiver. Psalm 108:8. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. This brings to close our study this hour. You can contact us at the 11th hour call. I'm going to close this service now with another song that I've written entitled Going to Take a Swim in the River of Love. Going to take a swim in the river of love. Going to wash away my troubles and strife. Going to help my friends and neighbors whenever I can. Gonna fill my heart with the gospel cheer. I'll spread the good news everywhere. Yahshua's coming, yes, he's coming back again. Won't you get ready? He's coming again. Won't you get ready? Invite a friend. Won't you get ready? Oh, don't delay. Won't you get ready? Won't you get ready for the judgment day? Stay in the middle of the river. Don't fear to either side, for the water runs deep and the river is wide. It's the river of life, so close to the sea. It's the river of life. The water runs deep and the water is free. Won't you get ready? He's coming again. Won't you get ready? Invite a friend. Won't you get ready? Oh, don't delay. Won't you get ready? Won't you get ready for the judgment day?